Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Come to the station, jump from the train, march at the double down Lover's Lane. Then in the glen where the roses entwine, lay down your arms, lay down your arms, lay down your arms and surrender to mine.
Hello and welcome, history friends, patrons all, to 1956, episode 2.3. We're going to keep motoring on ahead with this story as we trace the events which led to the Suez Crisis. If Budapest was our main event in the first part of this series, Suez is where we're going here, and last time we saw the British side of things and how the Anglo-Egyptian-French relationship was anything but cordial. The Suez Canal, as we saw, was still a critically important base for British interests. Despite the passage of two world wars and the removal of the Indian jewel in the crown, for the sake of British security, it seemed impossible to relinquish the Suez Canal to the native Egyptian government. This was a difficult stance to take because, as we also saw last time, Egypt was undergoing some revolutionary change, seen in the Free Officers' Revolution on the 23rd of July 1952, when several high-ranking Egyptian army officers overthrew King Farouk's tired regime and set out to represent Egypt on a new platform, independent, equal, and free from foreign domination or intrigue. To achieve these ends, of course, it was critical for Colonel Nasser, the leading light of the movement, to meet the British head-on and to remove them through whatever means proved necessary from their entrenched position in Suez. The two powers, in other words, were destined to butt heads, and in the midst of these incompatible policies were the interests of the Americans, the French, and the dangers posed by the Soviets. It was a complex, tangled web of intrigue that was being spun in London and in Cairo, and we're going to do our best to detail a good chunk of it here. So if you're ready, I will now take you all to November 1953.
The British Joint Chiefs' memorandum on the Suez Canal and on the British justification for staying in the canal zone despite the net disadvantages for the Anglo-Egyptian relationship reads like something more out of the Victorian era than out of 1953, the post-Second World War world, where we just assume almost automatically that the British were engaging in some heavy decolonization. The memo that we're looking at here was circulated in late November 1953 to the Foreign Office, and it said, "Although the canal zone would not be so valuable to us in the future, it was still worthwhile trying for prestige purposes alone to obtain our present objectives in the discussions with the Egyptians. Military as well as political prestige was involved. Although the canal base would be completely defenseless from the air point of view, it should be useful for supporting the smaller forces now envisioned." The only thing more ludicrous than the idea that the British needed to stay and police the canal to prove that they were a leading power was the tactics Winston Churchill attempted to make use of to ensure that Britain could not be pushed out of the region. To bring the Egyptians into line, Churchill believed that all means should be used, including the military means which Britain was not truly in a position to make use of. We are reminded that Churchill, at 80 years old by the time he relinquished the premiership, saw the present strategy in terms not of the changing circumstances of the era, but in terms of agreements and circumstances made 20 years previously, when everything was very different to the way it was now. On the 13th of December 1953, Churchill told Anthony Eden, Foreign Secretary for the time being, but Churchill's replacement from spring 1955, that the exit from all your troubles about Egypt, the Suez Canal, the Sudan, southern Sudan, and later the Middle East will be found in deeds, not words, in actions, not treaties. What security have we got that the Egyptians, now breaking your treaty of 1936, will keep any agreement you will make with them? Churchill, using language which placed the burden of responsibility on his long-suffering foreign secretary, continued in this long memo by saying, "On the contrary, it is almost certain that increasing bad blood will develop between us over the Sudan, that as our troops in the canal zone diminish in strength in carrying out the proposed agreement, the Egyptian riots and petty attacks will continue to increase. We shall no longer have available the force to occupy Cairo, etc. All that will happen is that our troops will be tied up halfway through their evacuation, and many in our own party will be able to say, 'We told you so,' while the others mock." Churchill's fears at being made to look unimportant, at losing political capital, or at coming away from Egypt with a bad deal, led him to recommend strategies which don't gel well with the traditional image of him as a courageous war hero bent on standing up to tyranny. As we've established, neither Churchill nor his successors came off especially well from Suez, yet the image of Churchill arguing for a reversion to the imperial policies of yore for the sake of maintaining the prestige of the nation stick out today as especially misplaced in 1950s Britain, when rationing, by the way, still remained in place, and the Cold War had clearly created a two-power equation. If Churchill was so concerned about the prestige of Britain, why not focus on ending rationing once and for all? Of course, the point is that Churchill's advice to Eden wasn't totally out of place, since several members of the Tory party at the time were by no means over the hill of imperialism just yet, and many had made their careers in far-flung empire posts to begin with. These conservative veterans held Churchill in suitably high regard, but it is worth considering the possibility that by holding so tightly and fondly to the glorious past, they failed to see what was to come in the future, or what was actually happening in the present. It was simply impolitique to adhere to the kind of strategy which Churchill was about to advocate, as the aged Prime Minister wrote, "Find some reason to send two battalions of infantry and three or four squadrons of RAF by air to Khartoum, Sudan. The governor could perhaps claim that public order required it as protections. The thing is not to talk about this, but after close, secret, intimate study among a few people, to do it. Once this sign of strength and action of policy and design has been shown, all the conservative troubles here would be quenched. The negotiations with Egypt would of course be broken off or lapsed, but the evacuation would be declared and would begin nonetheless, and the redeployment of our troops to the extent of an armoured division of four brigades in the Middle East and Cyprus could begin and proceed as fast as convenient. The Egyptians should at the same time be told that all fresh additional expense caused by riotous attacks on our troops or rear guards and all damage done to the installations of the obsolescent base would be charged against their sterling balances. There was no alternative to this approach except a prolonged, humiliating scuttle before the world, without advantage or goodwill or fidelity from those Egyptian usurpers to whom triumph is being accorded." It didn't seem to bother Churchill that sending such forces into Sudan would appear terribly cynical and imperialistic, especially since the Sudan had only recently been promised independence in line with the Egyptian New Deals. Incidentally, Sudan would officially declare independence on the 1st of January 1956, but for some time the assumption was that Sudan would form a kind of union with Egypt. This was certainly Nasser's expectation, and even while this proved false, the British would try in vain to forge a unique or special relationship with Khartoum. The newly independent Sudanese government didn't want to know about special British deals, and it would establish warm relations with Egypt over the coming years, even while Nasser always wanted more. A brief consideration of where Sudanese politics led only highlights the insanely provocative policy which Churchill was advocating here. Not only would Britain be seen to plainly violate its own promises by injecting a load of raw power into the Sudan after pledging to leave, but the act would force Nasser's back against the wall. Eden, as ever, attempted to traverse these difficulties with tact, commenting to Churchill that, "On balance, disagreeable as all this undoubtedly is, to go for the treaty still seems to be the only course. If this is so, I am sure we can persuade the overwhelming majority of our party, provided we stand fast and stand together. If the treaty cannot be obtained, then we shall have to fight it out." Churchill was angry at Eden's lack of cooperation, but he was doubly angry at what he saw as President Eisenhower's lack of understanding. Throughout the second half of 1953 and into 1954, the major stumbling block to Anglo-Egyptian negotiators reaching a deal on the Suez Canal occupation zone was, essentially, what the British technicians staying behind would actually wear. No, really, that is what they disagreed about pretty much the most. Nasser demanded plain clothes or overalls for these technicians, or no uniforms at all, while the British insisted upon military-style uniforms. You can probably see why it was a hot-button issue, but it still seems incredible that they spent so much time arguing over it. The issue was, of course, bigger than what was being worn. What mattered was what these clothes symbolised, because if British technicians wore something resembling military fatigues, then it would be easier to claim to the British public and among the Conservative Party that Britain retained a military presence, just as it would be easy for Nasser's critics, silent though they were at the moment, to point to the British in military uniform and say, "Hey look, they still have soldiers here, even though you said they wouldn't." For this exact reason, it was impossible for Nasser to approve of it, because he needed every vestige of military power that Britain had gone from the canal, or else his own regime's credibility would suffer. It was, at the end of the day, an issue of credibility, and neither side believed they could afford to lose any. Eisenhower and his Secretary of State, John Foster Dulles, had little time for the British intransigence. As far as Washington could see, London was needlessly dragging its heels, where compensation was plainly impossible. Times had changed, and while Eisenhower exercised as much patience as he could, he was determined to communicate to the British that they would have to, at some point, fall in line with these changed circumstances. The Allies couldn't afford to butt heads over Egypt when Nasser held all the advantages, and grave threats could emerge from other directions as they were distracted. In addition, as we learned at the end of the last episode, the Americans were attempting to devise some kind of League of Middle East and North African states, which included Egypt as its anchor. Britain's argument over what clothes should be worn complicated and delayed this process, and Eisenhower was becoming weary of having to make allowances for Britain's hurt pride. In the event, the Egyptians made some limited concessions regarding the scenarios which would enable the canal to be militarized, and in return the British made concessions about their withdrawal process. British withdrawal would take place over 2 years from July 1954, and the agreement itself would last 20 years. Churchill, as recently as March 1954, had pressed again for the dispatch of forces to Khartoum, so Anthony Eden knew that Churchill wouldn't approve of any plan that saw the whole-scale withdrawal of British troops from the canal zone, unless, Anthony Eden reasoned, the Americans could be seen to wholly support these latest agreements. Eden worked on the British ambassador in Washington to hurry the process along, which worked remarkably well. It worked so well, in fact, and the Americans seemed so eager to cooperate with these latest progressive Anglo-Egyptian relations, that Eden suspected something might be up, and in a sense it was. Washington had plainly moved on from Egypt, and the whole process of negotiating a new arrangement for the Suez region had left them with several headaches which Eisenhower felt had not been needed. Egypt, in the mind of America's leadership, was no longer as important in the Cold War arena as it had once been. Some British officials in other states where the Americans were active, such as Turkey, recognized this change as coming from the American plan to link several Middle Eastern states together in a defense league. If this was done, then Egypt would be secured by virtue of being surrounded by a defensive belt of states. Then there would be no danger to it during a war, no danger to the Suez Canal during that same war, and thus no need for the British to have their knickers in a bunch about the whole process. If you're following the Korean War at the moment, then you'll know that we've covered Turkey's participation within it, and also Turkey's entry into NATO. Turkey's participation within the Korean War was almost directly linked with Ankara's desire to join up with NATO and acquire American military and financial aid to combat recurrent Soviet threats on its border. In mid-1954, American policymakers saw Turkey as an anchor for their defensive league, and as such they maintained an active legation there, which frequently talked with the British on site. The Anglo-American relationship was good enough in Turkey, at least, to convince the British ambassador of the importance of a northern tier defensive league in place of the traditional anchoring of defensive interests in Suez. The British ambassador in Turkey wrote, "It is hoped by this means to construct a roof over the vulnerable Middle East region, which will help towards the containment of Russia in the Cold War, and eventually be able to play an effective part if a hot war should break out." If such a detailed defensive system was being developed by the Americans, then a merely Egyptian solution was surely a waste of time. Eden received whiffs of this truth just in time to realize the importance of helping the Americans along with their northern tier system and granting the concessions on Egypt which would have to be made eventually. Through these measures, Churchill will be greatly miffed and put out, but Eden had to consider the fact that Egypt was merely one spoke in the wheel of world defense, and this wheel couldn't be turned without sufficient American aid and native cooperation. Matters were thus settled in Egypt's favour, because Egypt possessed the leverage absent in Britain, and Eden seems to have tacitly accepted this. The agreement was finalised and signed in July. According to its terms, the Suez Canal base could return to a war footing in the event that Turkey, Egypt, or any other Arab country, part of the developing defence treaty, was attacked. British troops had to leave the base within 20 months, after which point civilian contracted employees would take over, paid for by the Suez Company. The agreement acknowledged the Suez Canal as a waterway economically, commercially, and strategically of international importance, and inserted a provision which recognized the determination of both parties to uphold the 1888 Convention guaranteeing the freedom of navigation of the canal. The 1888 Convention represented something of a blast from the past, in that it had clearly been established in very different times. Yet that convention's founding principle of free navigational access through the canal was to be upheld. There was to be no special privileges or bias towards particular traffic. Nasser was full of beans at the signing, declaring his desire to embark on a new era of friendly relations with the United Kingdom, and adding that, "We want to get rid of the hatred in our hearts and start building up our relations with Britain on a solid basis of mutual trust and confidence." To this, Anthony Eden, back in London, responded thus, "I am delighted that full agreement has now been reached between our two governments. We welcome this important step forward towards a new understanding and friendship between our two countries. We shall do all in our power to make the agreement work in a spirit of cooperation and in the interests of peace. I know that is also the purpose of your government." If Eden had publicly moved on from the old aims of holding on to Suez, he would have known that many of his colleagues had not. Even Churchill glowered at his Labour opponents when Clement Attlee's opposition seemed to take notable glee in this withdrawal, dressed up as something completely different. This wasn't necessarily because Attlee was against withdrawing from Suez, but because when he had advocated a similar policy in Iran, Churchill, at that point in opposition, had held the place down with accusations that Attlee had scuttled Britain's prestige and opportunities. Now, it was Churchill that faced the harsh realities of the post-war world, but the aged Prime Minister didn't recognise, at least publicly, the Anglo-Egyptian agreement for what it was. Instead, it was dressed up as an opportunity for the British to redefine their role in the Middle East by engaging with the American northern tier idea of strategic alliances. This task was made immensely difficult thanks to the heavy CIA involvement in Egypt, whose agents continued to speak to Nasser about great and ambitious alliance blocks that had his Egypt at the centerpiece. This idea of Nasser dominating any alliance plan which went ahead gelled with Nasser's own inbuilt ambitions, of course, and his personal desire to recast his regime as the pillar of Arab nationalism. A somewhat curious aim, since nobody was quite sure what Arab nationalism meant at this time. On the one hand, the CIA was telling Nasser that he was Washington's pick to be first among equals in whatever alliance agreement that emerged, and on the other, the British were painfully unaware of these communications and could only offer Nasser an alliance on the same bland basis that they could offer to everyone else. Then Eisenhower made representations to Churchill's government, unaware himself at the extent of the CIA's independent activity in Cairo, and exactly what they were whispering in Nasser's ear. Of course, it has to be emphasised that Churchill and then Eden were blissfully contented to march ahead with a defence plan that held British rather than Egyptian interests at the centre. More than that, if British interests in any hypothetical defence pact was better served by having Iraq lead the way, for example, then that was what London would do. This disregard for Nasser's feelings, while the CIA pumped him up, only served to make the Egyptian leader more defiant and the Anglo-Egyptian relationship more strained. Another relationship which suffered throughout 1954 was that of Britain and Israel. The Anglo-Egyptian agreement hadn't made any mention of Israel, and Israel was notably absent from the list of countries which, when under attack, would entitle Britain to reactivate her military presence in Suez. In addition, the tying up of several countries in the looming defence pact for the region limited Israel's options, especially if one of these states attacked her. As ever, Israel's relations with Egypt were tense and never moved past cold toleration of each other's presence. Anglo-American solutions to this tension were typically naive. It was hoped in both London and Washington that by improving the relations of the two strategically important states, any proposed alliance bloc would be just easier to establish.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com. A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
This may have been the case, but one of the only things that Nasser and Israeli Prime Minister Moshe Sharet could agree on in late 1954 was that the Northern Tier alliance bloc was bad news. Israeli think tanks saw the alliance bloc as empowering Israel's neighbours and reducing her foreign policy freedom of action. Nasser, as we saw, was inherently suspicious of any alliance bloc which was led by the West, especially as the self-interested CIA officials, who only wished deep down to swap British influence in the region for their own, continued to massage his ballooning ego. As 1954 became 1955 then, not only had Churchill's government plainly lost ground in Egypt, but he was also finding it nigh on impossible to gain any sufficient ground in the Middle East to make up for this. One effort, codenamed Alpha, had done the rounds in Anglo-American circles, and it had revolved around the curious notion that if only Egypt could be connected via a land bridge to Jordan and the rest of the Arab world, the Israeli-Egyptian tensions would be greatly reduced. What land bridge would be used? Well, how about this useless piece of desert and mountains that nobody wants, the Negev? What's that? Jewish settlers do actually live in the Negev, including Israel's first Prime Minister, David Ben-Gurion? Well now, that's something of a problem, isn't it? Alpha was a flop before it even got started, even with the large Anglo-American efforts to settle some Israeli debts, resettle some Palestinian refugees, and bulk up her defences. Despite the lackluster progress, the negotiations over Alpha typically dragged on into March 1956, whereupon Evelyn Shuckburgh, a Foreign Office expert on the Middle East, sent a memo to his friend, another man with a woman's name, Yvonne Kirkpatrick, a civil service official within that Foreign Office. The two men were good friends, and both Evelyn Shuckburgh and Yvonne Kirkpatrick communicated regularly during the early 1950s as conservative foreign policy took shape. We will certainly have reason to revert to Evelyn Shuckburgh and Yvonne Kirkpatrick in the future, but for now, Shuckburgh was making an appeal of sorts regarding the failure of Alpha. He released a memo to the effect that, The active effort to find a Palestinian settlement by negotiation between Nasser and Ben-Gurion has been the hidden linchpin of our Middle Eastern policy. So long as these efforts had any prospect of succeeding, we were able to avert our eyes from the basic dilemma in which we stood. The collapse of Alpha last week has removed the linchpin. We now have nothing we can offer the Israelis as an alternative to the terrible choice, either to attack soon or be slowly strangled by the unrecoiled Arab world, which grows stronger every day in wealth, self-confidence, and Soviet arms. We are left without a Middle Eastern policy of any kind. So what was going to happen if the British couldn't find a way to make the Israelis and Egyptians see eye to eye? In the mind of this official, the outcome was nothing less than perpetual warfare in the Middle East. He wrote, "The tension and despair of the Israeli position will grow rapidly, and public opinion in the UK and the United States will find it impossible not to support and arm them, despite the appalling consequences of doing so. In fact, unless the Israelis commit an aggression, we are becoming daily more deeply committed to go to war against a Soviet-armed Arab world as soon as they feel strong enough or fanatical enough to attack Israel." Yvonne Kirkpatrick was something of a rising star in the British Foreign Office of the early 1950s. He had been a long-time associate of Anthony Eden's, and he was as old-school in his method of thinking as one could be. He retained an intense dislike for Nasser, which compelled him to recommend the Egyptian leader's removal at every opportunity. Initially, when Eden was Foreign Secretary, he was careful not to take Kirkpatrick's recommendations so seriously. After Eden's promotion and resulting adoption of a more hardline stance, which we'll examine in a bit, Kirkpatrick increased the tempo, and Eden, then Prime Minister, would prove more inclined to listen. Taking our narrative back to early 1955, though, and the real story wasn't yet the failure of Alpha, but the looming agreement between Iraq and Turkey, which would apparently significantly neuter the influence of Egypt. In response to this agreement, termed the Baghdad Pact, Nasser tabled a conference of Arab ministers in Cairo to build an independently supplied base of his own. The British ambassador in Cairo at the time this conference was ongoing, on the 22nd of January 1955, reported home to London that the unscrupulous propaganda in which the controlled press and radio and even Egyptian spokesmen at the conference table indulged greatly shocked not only independent observers but also the majority of the Arab leaders taking part in the conference. Whatever the truth to this, Anthony Eden saw fit to make a stop off at Cairo only a fortnight later during his planned trip to Bangkok for the Southeast Asia Treaty Organization, or CETO. During his visit to Cairo, Eden had the chance to meet face to face with the man who would later cause him so much trouble as Prime Minister. From the beginning, the meeting went badly, largely because of Eden's own blithe indifference to Egyptian sensibilities. To start with, as the guest, Eden should have offered to meet Nasser where the Egyptian leader wished. Instead, though, Nasser was invited, some would argue, summoned, to meet with Eden in the British Embassy, which remained the grandest and most impressively adorned building in the city. "What elegance," Nasser would observe. "It was made to look as if we were beggars and they were princes." Two notable accounts exist of the actual meeting between the two figures, once the initial awkwardness had been sorted out. The first paints Eden in a damning, foolhardy light, and was likely designed to win the sympathy of left-leaning British citizens. This version, given by former Labour MP and BBC journalist Woodrow Wyatt, reads as follows. Eden entered the room and called him Colonel Nasser, which Nasser hated. He walked up and down in front of the seated Nasser and lectured him on British policy in the Middle East, and where Egypt fitted into it. He invited no comment or discussion, and when his near monologue was over, he looked at his watch. "I'm afraid I must go now," Eden said. "I have to change for dinner. I thought you would like to know what our policy is. It's been very nice meeting you, Colonel Nasser." Nasser said to me, "I know I'm not very important, and Egypt is not very important, but I was hurt. The Russians sent me copies of secret correspondence with Washington. When I asked why, they said it was because Egypt is a very important country. Now I know this is only flattery, but at least they take the trouble to pretend to treat us as equals." Again, bad as Eden could be on his good and bad days, It is likely that this account by Woodrow Wyatt was embellished to serve his political ends and to paint Nasser as the victim of British imperialism after the event. A more reliable version of the meeting was given by an Egyptian journalist who was a good friend of Nasser's and who was actually present for the meeting, unlike Wyatt. This account read, "Finally, before the party broke up, Eden said he would like to get clear in his mind the conclusions he thought they had reached. First, Eden said, you appreciate the importance of the defence of the Middle East. Second, you have no objection to what Nuri al-Said, the Iraqi leader, is proposing to do, provided he keeps it to himself, i.e. that he does not involve other Arab countries in a defence pact. Nasser said yes to both. For all his sophistication and expertise, Eden had throughout given the impression of being on the defensive. He was dealing with an entirely new brand of Arab leaders, revolutionaries who owed nothing to his country or government, single-minded in their aims and confident in their ability to implement them. It was obviously going to be quite an undertaking for Eden and his colleagues to take the measure of these new men." Whatever the true version of events, Eden returned home to London and by March 1955 had apparently forgotten everything that he had discussed with Nasser. Rather than ensure that the deal between Turkey and Iraq remained exclusive, as per Nasser's express wishes, Eden allowed and even encouraged the alliance to expand, adding in Pakistan and Iran to its mix. The final insulting cherry on top came when Eden advocated and received approval for Britain to join this four-way alliance, and the finished product linking Britain to Pakistan, Turkey, Iraq, and Iran was known as the Baghdad Pact. The pact has been lambasted by historians, with the historian John Kent writing in his book on Egypt and the Middle East that the pact was to be the basis, allegedly, for uniting the Middle East states against the Soviet menace. In reality, it was an attempt to fix another layer of prestige and credibility to Britain's declining military and economic power in the region. Aside from its wrongheadedness, the pact was bound to anger Nasser, who had been under the impression that Eden knew where Egypt stood. Nasser branched out with some diplomacy of his own, creating a pact with Syria and Saudi Arabia, which had little concrete power but which sent a clear message. As London instructed its ambassador to Cairo, Humphrey Trevelyan, to implement some damage control and assure Nasser of Britain's good intentions, including a pledge not to recruit any more members into the Baghdad Pact, Eden sent another, more hot-headed official to Jordan in a bid to do the exact thing Nasser had been told wouldn't happen, that is, expand the Baghdad Pact by adding Jordan to it. Nasser's outrage reached boiling point, and he successfully undermined British actions by intervening himself in Jordan, ratcheting up anti-British propaganda and pulling in some strategically placed Saudi monies. Before long, Jordan was in revolt against London, and Cairo was stepping forward to replace Britain as the paymaster of Jordanian interests. Anthony Eden's efforts at intrigue in the region had clearly backfired then. Not only had Nasser been first angered and then greatly encouraged, but even nominal allies like Israel were feeling the burn. The sight of two rival alliance blocs, one from Baghdad, the other sponsored by Nasser, alarmed Tel Aviv, which knew it would never be able to get a look into either agreement. Far better and safer it had been to keep the Middle Eastern states separate, but now British diplomacy was sharpening matters and ensuring that there was no way Israel could rely on Egyptian pledges of peaceful intentions. Successive failures led to the return of the premiership of David Ben-Gurion, who was more hardline and had a far more successful track record than any of his peers in office. The coming years were to test this record, but for now, Ben-Gurion aped the behaviour of the Egyptians by preparing for a war, which now seemed all but inevitable. The British-sponsored Baghdad Pact was to take further knocks into the spring of 1955 as Eden looked on. Above all, the American refusal to store their nukes in far-known bases removed the nuclear deterrent value of the pact, practically removing the point of the whole thing in the process. And then, once it became clear that the pact was having a negative impact on Israeli foreign policy, the considerable Zionist lobby in Congress virtually guaranteed that the pact wouldn't receive the blessing of President Eisenhower. Even if he approved of it in principle, he could never be seen to actively support or prop it up if it came into difficulty, which, of course, it did. Declassified documents now reveal that the British fundamentally misread the ability of the Soviets to penetrate their power into the Middle East, and thus there was really no need for the pact to begin with. This misreading came from an underestimation of Arab nationalism as a whole, but also from the resiliency of the newly independent Arab countries, like Nasser's, to resist foreign incursion and to stand on their own two feet. Anthony Eden was thus not having a very good time of things up to the moment when in late March 1955, it was learned that that scion of British politics, Winston Churchill, was about to hang up his boots for good, and to make way for Eden as a successor. Eden, so lackluster and short of success in foreign policy in recent years, was now forced to turn his attention to the question of domestic policy. An election would have to be won, and a post-Winston Churchill Conservative Party would have to be led. The challenge was a fierce one, and as we'll see, it was to prove Anthony Eden's ultimate undoing. Next time, History friends and patrons, I hope you'll join me as we detail Eden's assumption of the premiership and the redirection of his foreign policy towards a more hardline perspective as the shadow of Churchill weighed heavily upon his mind. Until then, though, my name is Zach, and this has been 1956, episode 2.3. Thanks for listening, and I'll be seeing you all soon.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.